Hello, this is Miles Crisp with another episode of Divergent History. This is the fourth episode, and it is Friday, the 12th of April, 2013. Okay, well, Fausto has fallen off of the edge of the Earth, apparently, so he's not here to join me, and you're gonna be blessed with more uninterrupted ramblings from myself. So, today, what I wanted to... What I want to get into is the story of Gaius or Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus. There's two Gracchi brothers. They were Roman. They were Roman nobles. They came from pretty elite families. The father of these two brothers, I don't remember his name, but it's pretty much the same thing. It's something Sempronius Gracchus. They keep naming themselves after each other. Anyway, he had been twice consul and also twice censor, which is a very prestigious position to have had in Rome. And in order to explain what Tiberius Gracchus did and why he's so famous and rather infamous in Roman history is because he essentially brought down or began to bring down the system of what some people would call democracy, but it's essentially the sort of republic that Rome had established. And in order to explain what Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus did and why it was such a big deal, I have to start with the beginning, with the founding of Rome, which historically, not the legendary founding, but historically, the Roman Republic began when they kicked out the last king, and that was in 509 BC. From 509 BC all the way until 31 BC, when you have the Battle of Actium, where Augustus Caesar defeated Mark Antony and Cleopatra and essentially assumed what you would think of as being the first emperor. Octavian never, or it later changed his name to Augustus, never wanted to be an emperor, and he called himself a princeps, which is basically a first among equals. The reason he did that is because at that point in the Roman history, they still didn't want to acknowledge that their republic had completely fallen. The Senate was still around, and basically, instead of Augustus just being an emperor the way you'd think of it, where he'd say we're going to do something and then we go and do it, he'd actually just suggest legislation and suggest courses of action to the Senate, and the Senate, of course, would grant him these wishes. So they sort of maintained this joke of a system up until much later. But still, you have the basic divide between the Roman Republic, where the Senate was dominant and there was no quote emperor, and then you have the Roman Principate, which again begins in 31 BC after the Battle of Actium and Augustus Caesar becomes the first, quote, emperor. All right. Well, how did the Roman system work under the Republic before you had the emperor? In 509 BC, that's when they pretty much cobbled this together, and you could debate when exactly the date was. That's a best guess by scholars. It's very hard to tell. Just one example, I think it was in the year 46 or 45 BC, Julius Caesar wanted to extend his consulship, which was a one-year term. Well, he was also the Pontifex Maximus, which was the head of the Roman religion, and it was the head of the Roman religion that decided when the next year would begin, and he decided to have a 400-something day-long year to keep himself in office. So the dates are very screwy. That's just one of many examples why. And when you have the founding of the Republic, you have a Senate, which has two consuls elected. The consuls are basically kind of like prime ministers to a parliament, more or less. They have the deciding vote, and they also decide what bills are going to be put onto the floor for debate and discussion. And you always have two consuls, they have a one-year term, and they could each veto the other's decision. If one of them vetoes something, the other one can veto the veto. And you end up with a stalemate until both of them agree. The idea, again, is trying to keep from having one ruler. The idea was to keep from having one ruler take command of and become a tyrant and act like a king. The whole system was designed around preventing that from happening at all costs. And the Senate, you know, it's called the Senate and the Roman people, Senatus Populosque Romanus. That's what SPQR stands for. The Roman people are an auxiliary attached to it. The senators were not elected from poor people or even working class or what you think of as maybe middle class people. No, it was all the elite. Think of all the rich businessmen just getting together and saying, okay, instead of, you know, competing with one another, let's try to get along so that we could all get even richer. And that's essentially what the Senate is. The Senate, I think, actually literally means the elders, a council of the elders. And the only constitution, the Romans didn't actually have a written constitution. It wasn't a, what you think of as a constitutional monarchy or a constitutional republic. The only constitutional thing they had, for all intents and purposes, was the idea of mos maiorum, which means the way the old people did it, or the way of the ancestors. So the whole thing developed on precedent. And if you created a precedent, generations down the line, they'd say, oh, well, so-and-so 8 generations ago, they did this, so that's what we're going to do again in this situation. The reason that I have to explain all that first is because Tiberius Gracchus created a precedent that essentially led to the downfall of this republic. And this is how he did it. He began he was a tribune, a tribune of the plebs. And a tribune of the plebs is not a senator. However, they can propose legislation to the Senate, and they could veto anything that the Senate comes up with, any legislation at all. And let me get this chat going here. All right. And because of this, I mean, you'd ask yourself, why is the system so screwy? Why can you possibly have a tribune that could veto the Senate? I mean, he basically has more power even than a consul. That's crazy. Well, in 494 BC, the poor people, which are called the plebs or plebeians in Roman terminology, were demanding reform, the reform of the laws and of the practices of debt bondage. Now, debt bondage, it's not like you take out a loan to buy a chariot, and if you fail to pay back that loan, you become a slave. It doesn't work like that. Debt bondage is a system in the ancient world, not just the Romans did it, but it's a system of acquiring for the elite a cheap source of labor. And they do this by providing sustenance for somebody who is indigent in exchange for not having to pay them anything else. You're technically a free citizen, but you're working on a plantation where you have to work on the plantation to get fed to live another day, to work on the plantation to get fed, et cetera, et cetera. So there's apparently you could often find yourself in full-blown bondage just because you had nothing. And in the Roman system, it's also important to remember the army had to supply its own equipment. If you wanted to become a Roman, just rank and file soldier, you had to supply your own shield, your own sword, etc. And that changed later during I think Marius and Sulla, leading up to Julius Caesar's time around the 50s, 60s BC. But anyway, originally, for the first 400, 500 years, all the Roman army was dependent on having a what you call a small holder. This might sound like conservative economics, but the way it happened historically is you had a lot of they were poor, but they weren't starving, and they would own a little bit of land, and they'd have a family on it, and they would farm it, and you would be able to raise enough money that way to essentially equip your sons to be able to join the army and then make more money and maybe buy more land and, you know, rise up in society. Well, by the mid-second century, which is about 150 BC and thereafter, it got to the point where the small landholder in the Italian countryside had been displaced by these elite plantations, which were called latifundia in Latin. And they were plantations just like the English had in Ireland and the United States. But they kept gobbling up all the small farms, and you ended up with this homeless population in the capital city of Rome, and they called them the headcount, the capitacensia. And they were called the headcount because that was all there was to count. When you take a census, they also record, you know, how many children you have, how many acres of, or they would call them eugera, but how large the land was, and that for purposes of taxation, and that's what the census was all about. It was for purposes of taxation. But anyway, Tiberius Sempronius Gracchus became a one-term tribune in 133 BC. And what he did was, and by the way, there's 10 tribunes elected every year, and each of these tribunes can veto anything the other nine proposes as far as legislation. And also, in order to have a law passed in the Roman system, the Senate would propose it, usually. And after that, it would go to be ratified by one of three councils that the citizens would participate in. And they voted in blocks. And the reason they voted in blocks is because more blocks of voting power would be assigned to the wealthier people, such that the wealthy 10% voted for about 90 or about 60 or 70% of the what you call now the Electoral College. So 80 or 90% of the population only had a say of about maybe 25 to 30%. And it was in that way that you had this, you know, people's acceptance of the legislation. Now, as tribune, it was his right to take a bill directly to the council of the plebs, the Concilium Plebum, and bypass the Senate. Now, if it had been something where, you know, there's too much horse shit in the streets and we need to have people come out and clean this up better, or this sewer's getting clogged and needs to be repaired, nobody would have batted an eye, and that was the sort of routine run, you know, just house maintenance, essentially, that the councils of the plebs would usually legislate on their own, independent of the Senate. Well, Tiberius knew that there was a big problem with this debt bondage and with the land, and like I said, this started right at the founding, but it took up until 133 BC for somebody to try to do something about it. And what he tried to do was he proposed a bill that would revive an older bill that came from came from 364 BC. And that bill of 364 BC said that a private citizen could only own up to 500 eugera of any public land, ager publicus. The public lands were essentially lands that the Roman Empire expanded into when they would conquer new territories. Remember, even in Italy, they were still conquering other peoples in Italy well into the second century. I mean, they had conquered them up by about 300 to 280 BC, but even after that, they were still sort of dealing with these provinces of foreigners, and they were taking their land and giving it to rich Romans. And these Romans were taking well beyond this 500 eugera limit. So Tiberius Gracchus' legislation was essentially just to enforce that older law so that you could give this land back to the landless mob, and the landless mob would be able to fund the army. And this would, you know, be a good thing for the country. But the problem with that was, for one thing, if you did that, all those poor people would rise up in society, and they would surely vote for Tiberius Gracchus. And that scares the Roman nobility. The Romans are very, very paranoid about a tyrant emerging from their number. They didn't want anybody to be in charge. Above all else, that's their big thing. And they were afraid that if this guy gave all this land to these people, he would be creating a middle class that would vote for him, and he could probably make himself, pull a Julius Caesar, essentially. So what happened was you had the Senate came up with a plan, and the plan was to contract a fellow tribune by the name of Marcus Octavius. And Marcus Octavius vetoed this legislation, this land bill of Tiberius. And that basically should have ended it. That would have, okay, you've been vetoed. That's the end of it. By the way, veto in Latin means I forbid. Anyway, and you also have to remember that you'd have these 10 tribunes standing on a platform in the Roman Forum with the whole mob of a large percentage of the city witnessing all of this. It was political theater. And above this, down in the Forum, above that on the hill where the Senate House was, the senators would be watching these proceedings. And Tiberius is said to, with tears in his eyes, clasping at his knees, begging Marcus Octavius to withdraw his veto. Octavius refuses. Well, says Tiberius, if you refuse to withdraw your veto, you're clearly not acting on behalf of the Roman people. So I suggest we all meet, and he set a date for several days forward where they would meet, and he was going to propose another bill that Marcus Octavius be deposed as a tribune on the argument that he was no longer acting as a tribune of the plebs. He was no longer acting in the interests of the plebs. Well, they all meet, and the voting proceeded to 17 blocks. This particular assembly had 35 voting blocks. When a majority of 18 was reached, voting ceased. Tiberius stopped the count at the 17th block, gave Marcus Octavius one more chance to withdraw his veto. Octavius refuses. The senators, of course, they're watching all of this. And voting goes to the 18th block, and the bill is passed, and Marcus Octavius is dragged ignominiously off of the speaking platform and humiliated. Well, That was new. Nobody had ever thought of doing that before, and up to this point. And Roman nobles at the time were scared to death that Tiberius was going to become a tyrant, because here's a tribune who doesn't have to deal with a veto from one of his colleagues, and also Tiberius made it known that he was going to stand for a second term. The next year, and that just inflamed the nobility. So, in response to this bill having been passed, the Senate still had control of the finances. So they granted them a pittance of this land commission to go around. They'd have to go around the country, survey the land, confiscate the surplus amount beyond the 500 ugra limit from the rich people, and then redistribute it to the poor. And the Senate granted them something like 10 cents a day to do this. So it was impossible. And that's when things get really interesting. Because, sorry, I've got kind of bad notes here. News came that King Attalus of Pergamum, which is basically northwestern Turkey today, had died, and in his will left his kingdom to the Roman Empire. Well, that was to become the province of Asia, and Tiberius proposed that some of that money be used to fund his land commission. And basically, by doing that, in one stroke, he challenged the Senate the two issues that it was just understood that the tribunes and the Council of the Plebs are never supposed to interfere with matters of foreign affairs and of internal financial issues. Well, this, and this was, you know, all right, so he got that. He got what he wanted. But he figured he would need another year in order to implement this, because this is coming, you know, about 6 months now into this. This all occurred within the first 6 months of the year 133 BC. So by July or June, he was pretty much figuring, well, with fall coming, I'm going to have to do this next year. And that's when he let it be known that he was going to stand for a second tribunate. And the Roman elite had had enough at this point. And the Senate had spies at Tiberius's political meetings. And there was one meeting where at a rally, the crowd was surging up towards him, and he felt that he was at, you know, in some pressure. And he had a sign that, you know, he was tapping on his head as a sign to his supporters, you know, back some of these people off, you know, help me get out of here, whatever. The Roman senatorial spies read the sign differently and rushed back to the Senate and said that Tiberius was calling for a crown, that he was going to make himself king. The Senate went crazy. They took bench legs, because weapons were forbidden in the city of Rome. They took broke off bench legs that were used at political meetings, and beat Tiberius and 300-something of his supporters to death, and his body was thrown into the Tiber like that of a common criminal. He had, in 6 months, transgressed the Roman concept of concordia, which is essentially balance and stability, getting along. He got rid of the breach of the limited terms of office. He got rid of the collegiality by deposing somebody who vetoed him, and he had usurped the traditional boundary and roles of the Roman Senate. Violence, once it was introduced into the Roman political system, didn't go away. And 10 years later, you have his younger brother. That's Gaius Sempronius Gracchus. And his younger brother was apparently much more of a firebrand than his older brother Tiberius. Gaius has served two or three terms as a tribune, and it must be remembered mentioned that in these 10 years, the law had been changed so that you could stand for tribune for one or two or 3 years in a row if you wished, as long as it was within reason. You couldn't, you know, do it for a decade or anything like that. And also the land bill from Tiberius was also carried out by this time, which means that it was basically his method of going about usurping the Senate that offended everybody more than the actual bill itself. And what I don't understand is why Tiberius, with all of his connections in the Senate, why he bypassed the Senate in the first place. I don't understand that. I guess he just didn't think he would be taken seriously, because they could have just told him, no, shut up, and that would have been the end of it. But his brother Gaius had a whole range of legislation that I can't get into because I'm not that familiar with it, frankly. But most of it was basically geared towards garnering support from the landless mob in the city. One thing that he tried to do was to suggest that grain be sold for less than the fair market price. And the Senate responded by saying, why have cheap grain when you can have free grain? We'll just start handing it out to you people. Don't vote for that guy. And another thing was he proposed that overseas colonies be founded to give some of the landless mob land. Well, the Senate responded by saying, we can give you land right here in Italy. You don't even have to travel that far. Again, don't vote for that guy. Vote for me. And it ends the same way. The Senate goes crazy, and actually everybody goes crazy, and Gaius Gracchus is killed by being pelted to death from the roof from roofs of people grabbing the Roman clay tiles that they would use for their roofs. Apparently were about 4 or 5 inches thick and 2 feet square. And these things raining down from 50, 60 feet in the air is what crushed him to death. And, you know, again, they created this precedent for why, you know, for having, you know, violence in the system. Later on, when you get into the 60s and the 60s BC and 50s, you have Sulla. And Sulla, this is another story, but he decided to march the army into Rome when they were having one of their many civil wars, and kill everybody that was against him. And he did this for about 4 or 5 years, and then he retired, apparently to pursue a litany of sexual perversions. But the idea of prescriptions, you might have heard the Romans would sometimes give out a decree that so-and-so person should be killed if anybody happens to see them. Well, he would put out these lists of rich people and political enemies and have them killed. And somebody at some point asked him, with all respect, as much as possible, when do you think you're going to have you know, finish with your prescriptions? And he said, well, I'm not sure. Let me get back to you. And he got back to him about a week later with a list of 250 people and said, that's as many as I can remember right now, but later it might change. So the violence just kept escalating. And by the time you get Julius Caesar, his actions weren't entirely without precedent. Sulla had basically usurped the Senate and made himself dictator. The only difference is that Sulla stepped down. Caesar got assassinated. And because of the chaos that ensued after that, Augustus was able to take control, mostly because everybody just wanted the bloodshed to end at that point. And after that, stability ensued. That's usually when you hear people, scholars, talking about the Pax Romana, which lasted more or less through the middle of the 2nd century AD. Yeah. Well, I don't know if anybody has any questions now or anything like that. I'm not used to not having Vosto here to talk to, so I think I might be going a little too quickly with some of this. But anyhow, another thing I was going to wanted to talk about when I was listening to the program on before this, Nyrese and Bob Earthwise talking about permaculture. I've recently started working on apple trees. My grandfather's taken ill with a recent back surgery, and I've been tending to his dozen or so apple trees, and he's also got some apra plums and pluots. If you don't know, a plum and an apricot can be crossbred with each other such that you get either a 3/4 plum and 1/4 apricot, or 3/4 apricot, 1/4 plum. The majority plum is called a pluot, and the majority apricot is called an apra plum. It's a thoroughly unpronounceable word. It makes you sound like you're having a stroke when you say it. But anyway, the tending is intensive, and you know, he uses some sort of copper spray that keeps the fungus down that needs to be put on at a particular time right before everything starts budding. And that's what I'm going to be doing bright and early tomorrow morning. So I can talk to you people about that next week, perhaps, if somebody's interested and asks me anything about it. Another thing is the story of the Gregorian calendar. Hang on. The golden apple of Eris was an apricot. I'm not sure. I haven't heard of that.
I am familiar that apparently apples as a domesticated plant came into Europe from China. I think it was the Chinese that originally domesticated most of the temperate fruit trees. Apples, peaches, pears, plums, apricots, I think all come from China, or at least East Asia. Okay. And, I know what I can get into. New World, start over here. The story of the Gregorian calendar. Not good at reading things while I'm talking at the same time. Sorry, guys, if I sound like I'm an idiot right now. But anyway, I'm going to talk about Gregorian calendar for a minute. Now, you had the Julian calendar before this, and like I said, there was one year where Julius Caesar made a 455 day year. So the dates were pretty screwed up. There were reforms done before the Julian reform, before the Gregorian reform, but in October of 1582, Pope Gregory decided to chop off he decided to chop off 10 days off of the calendar. And when he did that, it brought it back into line because the spring equinox was falling in February. And the calendar is essentially getting ahead of itself. How does a calendar get ahead of itself? Well, you have a leap year every 4 years. The Romans were familiar that the year was not 365 days, it was 365 and a quarter. Well, that's also not completely accurate. It's actually more like 365 days, 5 hours, and either 49 or 50 minutes. So every 4 years, you're skipping ahead by 40 minutes, roughly. And over the course of a millennium, that can screw things up. So what they ended up doing was they, like I said, they chopped 10 days off, and they decided that at the century mark, every fourth century, you would omit the leap day. If you look on your calendar, if you just look on your computer and go back to the year 2000, you'll notice that February only has 28 days. Well, it's the year 2000. In the year 1900 and 1800 and 1700, there was a leap year. But there was no leap year in the year 2000. That's because they decided to skip one on the century mark, one out of every four centuries. So 17, 18, and 1900 had leap days, but the year 2000 did not. And the next time that'll happen will be in the year 2400. Supposedly, this is supposed to reset it's supposed to compensate for what's already compensating the other direction by adding the leap year, and this should keep the calendar accurate until about the year 8000. I have a collage of things that I was going to discuss. I wanted to start with the Tiberius Gracchus and get the Gregorian calendar thing out. But otherwise, basically what I have to talk about is a variety of things from American history. And one of the things I was going to talk about was the Lowell Mill Girls. It's spelled W-O-W. Fucking hell. L-O-W-E-L-L. There's dyslexia incarnate for you. The Lowell Mill Girls. And this was a system of, again, acquiring cheap labor for the elite. But it was done during the beginning of the Industrial Revolution in the northeast of the United States. What they would do is they were having textile mills, and they needed young ladies to work in them. Well, they would go around the countryside and recruit from farming families daughters to come and work at what was essentially a combination of a boarding house and a labor camp. But the idea was that no
young lady would work a job on her own in this period of history, other than being a prostitute. So the company said, we'll have old ladies that'll take care of them, you know, no boys allowed kind of thing. They would essentially be quarantined in this boarding house, and they would work given hours, and you know, they'd feed them and clothe them and everything, and they would have money that they could send back home and all that good stuff. Well, they weren't mistreating them or anything like that. It was just very interesting to me because they had to go to great lengths in order to recruit these girls and ensure their families that they wouldn't be just roaming around on their own. This idea that the women always have to essentially have some sort of either husband or father figure or some other relative, or in this case, kind of like a boarding school, this company that would look after for them, and they were also providing them with some sort of education as well. And and this again was in the early 1800s. Another weird thing that was going around in the 1840s was the Oneida community, which was founded by a guy named John Noyes, N-O-Y-E-S, and it was in New York State, and he believed that Jesus came back in the year 70 and basically just... I'm not even going to get into it. It just sounds crazy. But anyway, it was all an excuse so that they could have what he called complex marriages, which is essentially polyamory, where you can have, you know, three wives and three husbands, and they're all, like, interconnected with each other. That's polyamory. That was kind of weird. They ended up getting run out of town. But the other thing is the Hudson Valley in New York, for some reason, in between like 1820 and 1850, you have the Mormon religion come out of that area. You have the Jehovah's Witnesses came out of that area. There were a lot of the temperance movement came out of that area, and also abolitionism came out of that area. The temperance movement and the women's suffrage movement that you think of in the 1920s used to almost be part and parcel of the same thing. You have a group that was called the Washingtonians. Abraham Lincoln was a member of that, and that was an association of reformed alcoholics. And they would go around from town to town. Every Sunday they would meet at, you know, after church, and they would tell these lavish stories of how they got really liquored up and did all this crazy stuff, or, you know, spent a night in jail or whatever. But it actually succeeded apparently in making a lot of young boys want to become alcoholics, just so that they could become reformed alcoholics, so they could become Washingtonians, because the Washingtonians were so entertaining and popular. But anyway, let's see here. Going through more notes. James Oglethorpe. He was the founder of Georgia, the state of, or rather colony of Georgia in eastern United States. He was a philanthropist who wanted to found a colony where people could all get a fresh start, and it ended up basically becoming a refuge for oddball Protestant sects and for Irish and Welsh and Scots and other people that otherwise wouldn't have been able to get established in colonies like Virginia and the Carolinas. He founded Georgia in 1733. And in 1739, he actually tried to conquer St. Augustine, Florida. He failed miserably. But by doing so, he's, by historians usually attributed, with having kept Spain out of Georgia. But, I don't know. I'm sorry, this isn't really going very well. I'm too used to having Vosto here to ask me questions. Okay. I don't know how to read French, but I'm going to pronounce it Cour de Bois, which was the term for Frenchmen that were the kinds of French that would assimilate with the natives. And the French did this best of all. The Spanish created a very intricate, racially based caste system when they came into Latin America. The English simply killed anybody else that they saw, be it French or native or anybody else. Well, the French weren't really like that. The French always had a very hard time keeping what's now Quebec and Canada, Eastern Canada, populated with French people. I think at the most there was something like 70 to 80,000 Frenchmen living in Canada. They just never really got that many people to go out there. And the people they did get to go out there would generally take a native wife and learn the language and essentially assimilate. They wouldn't completely assimilate, and what they tended to be were actually guides and people helping with the fur trade, because the natives needed sort of like a go-between. So they were called it's C-O-U-R-E-U-R-S and then D-E and then B-O-I-S, so Cour de Bois, something like that. That was an interesting thing. Now, another thing I can get into is the difference in the way the American colonies were established. In the North, you had towns, villages that would be established, and everybody would grow up around that town. In the South, it was based on what they called the headright system, which was a pattern of English settlement that predominated the American colonies where they began doing this in Northern Ireland. But essentially, they would create lots of land and sell them off. There was no limit to how many lots any one person could own. So even though initially it was designed so that you can get a whole bunch of people out there, what ended up happening is maybe at first to clear the land and establish it, you'd have sort of like entrepreneurs or poorer people subsistence farming on these little plots, but three or four generations later you'd have a plantation that had gobbled up 30 or 40 of these lots, and they would just keep expanding. And when you have a pattern of settlement like that, that discourages towns from being built, because you just have this, you know, everything's under agriculture. You don't have any cities or towns anywhere. And you don't have roads either, because they're founding these things off of navigable rivers. So even as recently as the 1930s, the roads in the South were much, there just weren't as many of them, because there hadn't been. You have a population that's not localized. It's just peppering the countryside. So there's no real incentive for a bunch of people to get together and make a decent road the way you would have if you had a village or a town, for example. And then when the Industrial Revolution begins, how are you going to have any industry if you don't even have a town or a road? So that's another reason why the South didn't have industry. I was going into that in either the last show or the show before that. I can't remember right now. Hello again. We're back with episode 4 of Divergent History. Miles Crisp again. Well, I'm still getting used to doing this, and Vosto having disappeared and all that good stuff. So there's my qualification. Now, I'm going to get into some of the human evolution stuff again that I was covering a little bit in the last show. The biggest thing to remember is that there's a big difference between a Homo sapien and any other Homo. Homo is a genus, and sapiens is the species. So Homo erectus is a different species, but the same genus as we are. And essentially, you've got the earliest one is Homo habilis, that begins around 2.5 million years ago. About 2 million years ago, you have Homo erectus, and the two were on, you know, parallel with each other for about 500,000 years. Homo erectus keeps living almost up until about 300,000 to 400,000 years ago. The had a pretty long run of almost, or let's say, 2.75 million of years. And in the last 500,000 years, you had three species of Homo that we know of on the Earth all at the same time. You had Homo heidelbergensis, Homo sapiens, and Homo neanderthalensis. Basically, you had Neanderthals, Homo sapiens, and sometimes the heidelbergensis is classified with Homo erectus. Sometimes it's its own thing. Depends on which school of thought you want to go with. Now, Neanderthals were around for about 400,000 years. We've only been around anatomically modern for about half that time, about 200,000 years. Some studies might date the Neanderthals a little further back to maybe 500,000, maybe even 600,000 years, but I'm not that familiar with their origin. I know they lived up until about 24,000 years ago, and the last vestige you see of Neanderthals is in western Spain. They essentially got trapped in the southwest corner of Europe when Cro-Magnon man came in. And Cro-Magnon man and Homo sapiens is the same thing. They're just named after the Cro-Magnon Valley in France where they were discovered. Just like Homo heidelbergensis was discovered in Germany near the city of Heidelberg. And so anyway, Neanderthals had tailored clothes somehow. We don't know if they were making leather because leather doesn't preserve, but in order to exist in during the peak of the Ice Age in Europe and not have any kind of animal skins on them, we don't think they would have been able to survive. So they had some sort of clothing. They did use fire, but not always. Sometimes if a tree caught on fire naturally, being hit by lightning or something like that, they would take the fire and keep feeding it and keep it alive, keep using it. But not every Neanderthal site has fire. Some Neanderthal sites have evidence of burial, that they actually buried their dead and left offerings with the dead. And that basically shows that they would have had at least some sort of concept of death. And that's an abstract thought, as far as we can tell. But there's other Neanderthal sites from the same time period elsewhere in the world, or in Europe, that Neanderthals are mostly in Europe and Southwest Asia, around the Near East, and North Africa. But there's other Neanderthal sites where they actually ate the dead, and they bashed up the bones so that they could extract the marrow, and just discarded the bones along with the bones of what other animals they were hunting. And that's why back in the 1800s and the early 20th century, the scholars were calling them cannibals. Because, oh, look at this. This is a race of ancient man that ate themselves. How terrifying. So some ate themselves, some venerated their dead. We don't know if they actually had abstract thinking, but more to the point, we don't know whether or not Homo sapiens had abstract thinking. And this gets into the debate between anatomically modern humans, which is the definition of a Homo sapien. The bones are such that they're anatomically modern. They're, you know, they are this species. But the behavior of that species can only be proven through archaeology, because this is from hundreds of thousands of years ago. And you have to have something that you can dig up and say they must have had abstract thinking. If you make a figurine or a carving of a bird or something, or if you paint something on a cave, these would be, you know, undeniable evidence that they were behaviorally modern. And for some reason, there seems to be this explosion of people being behaviorally modern in the fossil record after about 30,000 years ago. But people have been around for three times that. Four, or actually, six times that period of time for almost 200,000 years. So when did it change over, and why is one question. Another question is whether or not there ever was a change, and are we just looking at not a change in how this animal started acting, becoming behaviorally modern, but maybe we're just looking at a period in time when they were producing something that could be preserved that we could dig up and say they were acting behaviorally modern. So I think that if there's evidence of the species that evolutionarily essentially came before us, the Neanderthals burying their dead, if that could have happened, then it seems very plausible that there never was this explosion around 30,000 years ago of creativity and abstract expression with humans. But that was just some period in time when you were able to people started doing something that could be preserved. Another debate is, no, they weren't behaviorally modern, because why would you make the same arrowhead for 150,000 years and never change it? Homo erectus made one hand axe the same way for almost 2 million years. They never improved on it. They never changed it. You know, if it ain't broke, don't fix it. That implies that you do not have abstract thinking. You have almost monkey-like copying of the previous generation, so that it never really changes until they go extinct. Then it just goes away. Well, early humans were making the same kinds of arrow points and not really changing them terribly much. So that's a sign that there really was something that changed early man into thinking abstractly. There's a argument put forth by a few people, including Graham Hancock, that says it was actually the use of psychotropic drugs that got people to start painting on caves and making what you would think of as the beginnings of religion. Again, in the physical record, where you can actually see like an idol that was carved or something like that. Another thing is you have something called a therianthrop. It's T-H-E-R, therianthrop. It's a half animal, half man, like a centaur or a minotaur, or I guess technically a chimera would also be a theri. Well, no, it's just a mix of different animals. But anyway, one of the arguments is, how are you going to come up with these crazy ideas if you're not using some mushrooms or something like that? And with the change of the Ice Age, it got slightly warmer towards about 25, or, you know, like 20 to 15,000 years ago, it started getting slightly warmer. And maybe these mushrooms were able to proliferate more, and that's actually what made modern humans modern, was the use of drugs. There's that argument. Another argument is that the population rose to a certain extent where, since there's so many people, you end up getting, I guess the logic is, if you get enough people, somebody's going to come up with an idea, and the idea is going to spread and become like a religion. Or maybe religion was a result of social issues that arose from this increased population. People had to figure out how to get along with one another. So maybe that was why you got – nobody knows why we supposedly changed over from anatomically modern to also being behaviorally modern. I don't think we ever were anything other than how we are today. Honestly, I don't see why a species would just click over like that. That's very strange. Even some of the ancient alien arguments speak to that, where, you know, about, again, 30,000 years ago, cave paintings start coming around. Oh, the aliens came down, and that's what inspired them, because they were seeing all of this crazy stuff going on in the skies, and Well, another counter-argument to that from Robert Schock is that actually what was going on at the end of the last Ice Age was comets passing by and, what do you call them, those eruption events from the sun, where kind of like the Carrington event, where you have the you know, the plasma being released and it actually hits the atmosphere. It's essentially like an electromagnetic pulse. It'll take out any kind of wired stuff that was around. The Carrington event was in the 1850s and was actually blowing up the little shacks that the telegraph operators used. Now, of course, back then they wouldn't have had telegraphs or anything like that, but you would have seen a lot of weird stuff in the sky, and some of those things in the sky from the plasma hitting the atmosphere could actually look like kind of like stick figures. So it would have almost appeared literally like there was a glowing fireball figure in the sky. And I don't care if you're anatomically modern or behaviorally modern or what, if you see some shit like that, that's going to get your attention. And you're going to want to, you know, well, you don't have writing yet, so what do? You scratch it out on the side of a cave, or maybe you carve an antler or something like that. Perhaps it was seeing these things that, you know, made people. I don't need to keep bouncing forth with that, but that's one thing that could have caused the end of the last Ice Age. And another thing we have from the mitochondrial DNA. It seems that somewhere around 70,000 to 75,000 years ago, the global human population actually dropped to something in the neighborhood of 250 breeding females. And we know that because the mitochondrial DNA comes through the mother, and it seems that the genetic diversity of that has a bottleneck where it actually went down to, like I said, about 250 breeding females. And if I mean, it's hard to believe that was enough genetic diversity to keep us going, especially when you see how many different kinds of people there are in the world just ethnically. But that's another thing. Sometimes people refer to, you know, Homo erectus and Homo neanderthals as another race of man. I'd recommend staying away from that word if possible, because it's, although technically you could be correct in saying that, it's very misleading. And, you know, human ethnicity, or quote human races, which I don't even think exist, but it's sort of like, you know, the difference between an orange and white cat, or a mostly orange and somewhat white cat. They can all have the same mother. It's just, you know, some people have brown hair, some people have black hair or blonde hair. That's not enough of a difference to even call it a subspecies. So when you say, you know, race is just an antiquated term, I think, at this point. Now, if I'm going to say ethnicity, that, I'm going to argue, is an acceptable term, because I'm talking about a human culture and a human language and certain superficial characteristics physically. That's just the last part of it. The biggest thing with an ethnicity is really its culture and its language. And remember, language is a result of culture. It comes as a byproduct of culture. You could have society amongst insects. Society just means certain animals are doing certain things relative to others of the same species. Bees have their queen, and they have certain bees that take care of the babies, and other bees that go out and gather pollen and nectar to bring back to produce honey. And you have other bees that actually defend the thing from, I don't know, a bear or something, whatever bees have to defend themselves against. That's a society. But to have a culture is something, as far as we know, that's uniquely human. And that begs the question, did the Neanderthals have a culture? or did they just have a society? They could. We know this, that they were hunting large, woolly rhinoceroses and large land animals in the last ice age with a spear on the. They had an obsidian or chert spear point, and it was attached to a very hefty shaft that was probably about maybe 2 inches thick and 8 or 9 feet long. And they would essentially go right up against this animal in a coordinated effort with several other men, Neanderthal males, and just stab the thing to death. There's evidence that some of the Neanderthals would utilize, if you have a gully that has maybe a river running down it and it sort of narrows, has a bit of a bottleneck, they would actually wait at that location where the animal wouldn't have a lot of room to maneuver and try to kill it there. Having foresight and stuff like that to the scientists doesn't prove that they had abstract thinking. Cheetahs, wolves, they all do this, but they don't have language. They don't have, as far as we know, culture. They just have this survival mechanism relationship for dealing with their own kind. And the debate is, when did that happen with humans? Why did it happen with humans? And whether or not Neanderthals are in the same club as we are when it comes to this abstract thinking. Also, people are debating whether or not the Neanderthal had language. And part of this goes to the position of the larynx, L-A-R-Y-N-X, I think it's spelled. It's basically where your voice box rests. And in a human, it's higher up than it is on a Neanderthal. Again, we know this from where the muscles would attach onto the bones around the neck. So the argument is, well, the Neanderthals didn't have speech because they had too low of a larynx. They wouldn't have been able to make as many different sounds orally as we can. But human children, before adolescence, their larynx is lower. And then children can talk just fine, make all the same sounds as we do. Their voice is of a different pitch, but they can still make the same sounds. So that kind of throws that argument out. Do I think Neanderthals had language? I'm inclined to think that they probably had something, maybe a proto-language, a language that would have been probably entirely based on context, and maybe what they lacked was grammar. You can have languages that only have four verbs. I know it sounds crazy, but I think it's something like go, stop, become, and go away, or something like that, and you could just attach that to any noun you want. So if you want to say drive, you'd say go box, you know. But anyway, it's possible they could have. Wasn't the last ice age 11,000 years ago? That's when it ended. It ranged going way back to about 90,000 years ago. Then there's another interglacial, and then you have another ice age before that one. The Neanderthals survived two ice ages. Well, almost. They died out about 1,500 years before the last ice age ended. Some people today, mostly geology students, like to say that we're technically in an ice age right now. The only thing that ended was actually the glacial maximum cycle. There are periods in Earth history, I think you have to go back at least 3 million years to find the last time that you didn't have any ice on the poles. But it does happen. And you could have a super greenhouse effect the way you had, I know about 30 million years ago in the Miocene, you have some of the largest aquatic animals ever. There's a shark I saw the bones of at a museum in this, in Calvert County, Maryland, which is on the western coast of the Chesapeake Bay in southern Maryland. And this shark skeleton was 67 feet or 77 feet long. It was enormous. And how could you... it's not hard to figure out why that thing went extinct, because if you're that large, the amount of food you have to consume is so great. You have to have an incredibly fertile, productive, in other words, hot and warm planet. The warmer the planet gets, theoretically, the more life you're going to have on it, because the further north and further south towards the poles it can live. There's more tropical life than there is Arctic life. So the warmer the planet, the more biodiversity, the more food supply you have, the larger a predator can grow to become. As soon as something changes, that food supply goes away, those big predators are the first to die because they're the most susceptible. Now, if you've got the little fish that the big fish eat, well, they're dependent on less of the system below themselves. You know, they're basically less complex. So the more complex you get, the more at risk you are of something beneath you in the food chain collapsing that would make you die. What was the distribution of humans across the planet? Well, I'm assuming they mean early on. We came out of Africa. I'm in that school of thought. If you think we came out of Australia, more power to you. There's some evidence for it. Don't get me wrong, but I don't agree with that. So I would say we came out of Africa approximately 180 to 150,000 years ago. The first place we went was the ancient Near East, and human beings made it to Australia before they went to Europe. The reason is because if you're naked, and let's just assume for the sake of argument that all humans were naked back then. They hadn't invented clothes yet because they didn't need to. It's hot in Africa. It's hot in Saudi Arabia. It's hot in southern India. It's hot in, you know, Thailand and New Guinea and northern Australia. You don't need clothes. So humans followed the climate where they could live. And at the time, up until about maybe 40,000 years ago, Europe was so cold and or locked with ice that Homo sapiens weren't there. Australia was colonized by humans before Europe. But during that time, the Neanderthals were in Europe, and they were sort of isolated from us. Well, not sort of, they were isolated from us. And there are also Neanderthals in Asia that died out before the ones in Europe. So sometime from, say, 150 to 50,000 years ago, the Asian Neanderthals died. Whether or not we killed them, we don't know. An interesting statistic, though, is that one-third of all Neanderthals that have ever been found in archaeology sites have a human arrow point in their bodies. So we know we killed at least a third of what we've found so far. And those are not just in Europe, but everywhere. I think almost all of them are in Europe, though. I'm in the school of thought that thinks humans did not kill the Neanderthals off, but we actually out-competed them and out-hunted them. Isn't there a lot of archaeology lost under the sea? Absolutely. It's probably one of the most unfortunate parts of all of this that I've learned is that if you want to figure any of this stuff out, it's almost impossible because it's buried 200 meters under the sea in the continental shelves. There's a sunken landmass called Sunda, which is in, it's essentially Southeast Asia being connected all the way through, Indonesia. There's riverbeds that keep going under the sea. Like we could see when the sea levels were lower that there used to be a river valley and you know, we could actually see topographical features under the water right now. That would be the place to look if you wanted to find evidence for a global or any advanced civilization before about 11,000 years ago. Most people even today live along the coasts, so it's fair to assume back then people would have also lived along the coast, and probably most of the sites are now buried underwater. But that doesn't mean you're going to find it in the middle of the ocean. It's going to have to be in the shallow areas. The most of the sea levels were ever down was about minus 150 meters from how it is today, when you would have had humans walking the earth. Is Atlantis just a Greek story, or does it have foundation in archaeology? Well, Atlantis is a Greek story. There's no disputing that. But is it a story of something that has or could be proven in archaeology? Some people suspect Santorini. Some people suspect Sunda in Indonesia. And some people even suspect Titicaca in the high Andes in Peru and Bolivia. I don't know of any archaeology from it, other than the Santorini theory. By the way, Santorini is an island in the Aegean Sea that basically blew itself up, and now it's a big harbor, but it used to actually be an island. The whole thing just blew up and would have created a big ash cloud over all of the East Mediterranean, and we think that might have brought down the Minoans around, I think that was 1500 or 1400 BC. I think Atlantis is the Greeks' version of a story of people that used to live. Like last week, I was talking about how the Pima would remember the Hohokam from whom they were descended, and they had mythologized their memory of these people. They knew somebody was running around out there. They knew somebody made these canals and stuff, but they didn't know who did it, so they just sort of made up a story. Well, Atlantis could be the same version of that, just over a longer period of time, and maybe this is the Greeks through the story comes from Egypt, actually. I think it was either Herodotus, or I don't remember the Greek guy that came up with the story, but he got it from a guy in Egypt, and the Egyptian guy said that it was very, very, very ancient thing that somebody in ancient Egypt had heard from somebody else. So you have this relay race of telling this story, and of course, like any game of telephone, it becomes more corrupt and grandiose the further down the line it gets. So I think, yeah, Atlantis is probably a dim memory, like a child would have a memory of an event that happened amongst its parents or something at maybe the age of six. You're going to have a very simple, skewed, mythologized version of the event that actually occurred. And I think that's probably what Atlantis is, because the core of it is basically advanced civilization, long time ago, water rose or land sink or whatever. Somehow it flooded, and they spread around the world, and we're getting little chunks of knowledge from that. Well, that could have been any number of things. There could have been 20 or 30 Atlantis-like societies running around 20, 30,000 years ago, for all we know, because all of the evidence would be buried under the sea. They would have had no reason to go inland, and if they did go inland, they probably wouldn't have built too much for us to discover archaeologically. So it's kind of ironic, but one of the things that almost lends credence to the theory is the fact that you have no evidence to lend credence to the theory. Because if you're going to have a oceanic kind of like look at the Polynesians. The Polynesians can use the stars and have memorized the currents and can sail to all of these islands. They don't even have a writing system. They just tell stories and learn how to do it from an early age. If that all got flooded and the descendants were, you know, forced to kind of in exile spread around the world and come into other groups of people and assimilate into them, after 10 or 20, you know, hell, even after 100 years, you're probably not going to have any real recollection of what had been before. And certainly after 10 or 15,000 years, you're not going to have any recollection at you know, beyond some sort of mythic tale. And you got flood stories from almost everywhere in the world. I think, again, that that's a cultural, mythological memory of the seas rising. And there's an article in National Geographic, or might have been a BBC thing, but there were early humans living in England when it was still connected to the mainland. And the English Channel would have been a river valley. At the bottom of this broad valley, you would have had a river. And they've actually named that river, too, and I don't remember what it's called now. But anyway, as the seas were rising, you would have these people that would come to fish on the coast. Well, the coast was flooding, and you would have this landscape where you'd still have oak trees, you know, old-growth forest, but it's now a swamp that is chest-deep in tidal ocean water, and you'd go there in low tide and go to your little fishing place. But they found archaeological evidence that says that even as this was occurring, they kept going to the same place. That's a very, very strong skill to have, to be able to keep going to the same location as the landscape is being changed. It went from being a forest to being a beach to being a beach swamp to being just water, and you had to move back inland. And all this while, they kept going out there and they kept working with and noticing and adapting to these changes. So there would have been a long period of time, generations and generations of people remembering, you know, flooding, essentially. So it would only stand to reason that that would become a very common theme amongst people all around the world, because unless you're in the middle of nowhere in the center of Asia, you would have been affected by this. Even even things like the River Thames would have been completely different before these sea levels rose. London would have been high and dry back then. There might have been a little bit of a river, but it certainly wouldn't be tidal. You wouldn't have ships coming in it the way you do now. Excuse me. Yeah. So you have the debate between how many species of Homo that there were. And like I said, they can't even get down whether or not Heidelbergensis is or is not Homo erectus. So it's a wide open field. There's not a lot of people studying it. And I even went and got into it for a while and decided, because there's so little evidence, that it's not even worth really studying right now. What do you make of the Piri Reis map or Piri Reis map? I think the Piri Reis map is based on arguably one of the most ancient forms of I think it's based on one of the strongest lines of evidence we have for a civilization to have existed before the end of the Ice Age. The reason I say that is because one of the maps that it's based on shows Antarctica before it had ice on it. And Antarctica wasn't ice-free before about 3 million years ago. So not only is it before the end of the last ice age, it's before 5 ice ages before that, and into a period when it was still warm, coming off of that warm period 30 million years ago where you had those giant sharks. There's a German scientist in the 1910s that discovered in Africa an anatomically modern Homo sapien skeleton in what was, I think, 1.8 or 2 million year old rock. And rock, of course, is dated relatively. It's, you know, this layer is below that layer, therefore it's older than the layer above it. Through that means, he came up with that date. Well, the bones were apparently scattered and burned and destroyed mostly during, I think, either the Great War or World War II. And sometime in the 50s or the 60s, there was a scientist who carbon dated what was left of what he said were the bones from this archaeologist, and said that they were only about 50,000 years old. Well, the guy was apparently defamed and kicked out of the college he worked at because he was falsifying radiocarbon dates of bones. And we don't even know whether or not he was actually radiocarbon dating the actual bones from the site, because it was lost in the museum, and there was a box of random bones that they think was from that expedition. So there is actual scientific evidence that humans could go back much further. And if Homo erectus could survive for 2 million years, why couldn't we have? But that would also beg the question, if we're that ancient, why do we only pop up in the fossil record after 200,000 years ago? So it's kind of like you've got Homo sapiens 3 million years ago. Either we left the planet or we just stayed in Africa and left no remains that have yet been discovered, other than this one controversial site the German guy found. And then somehow around 150,000 years, we blow up in number and then leave Africa, and it's the archaeological record as we know it today. That's very hard to reconcile. If anybody wants to really get into to that side of things, Michael Cremo has done a lot of work on what he calls forbidden archaeology. And that's where I'm getting everything I just told you from. Do you think Bigfoot exists? Perhaps in areas we don't really explore. Yeah, anything's possible. The thing is, if there is a Bigfoot creature like that, it's so intelligent, it might as well be considered the most intelligent species on the planet, because it's been able to hide from us for all of these years. Yeah, there's areas that we don't explore very much, but you would think, you know, somebody would have found something by now, at least a dead one. Or something like that. So if they do exist, I would have to say they are extremely intelligent. And again, if they're extremely intelligent, why would they want us to know about them? And there's other ideas that Bigfoot and the Yeti and the ghoul of Arabia and various boogeymen in other cultures could be a cultural memory, like Atlantis is sort of a cultural memory of the time when we were ranging with Neanderthals. Maybe there's something in us that keeps thinking in the back of our heads, oh, of course there's other hominids around. There's always been other hominids around. It's somehow like in our instinct through evolution that we are used to there being other species, and maybe there were other species that have survived, and that would be, you know, Bigfoot and Yeti and Sasquatch. Thus does Sasquatch exists? Well, not today he doesn't. But I don't know. I if you want to talk about cryptids, look in the oceans. There's things in the ocean that can live in conditions we never would have thought possible. And some of them are used to living at the bottom of the ocean where there's so much pressure. If you actually bring them up to the surface, they turn into jelly and they just spread out on the table. They die, obviously, because they're used to having so much pressure around them. There's a glass-like jellyfish that lives in the very, very cold water around Antarctica. And, you know, when you increase the salinity of something, you can bring water below freezing. So this creature exists in water that's sub-zero, and because of that, it's able to maintain this what would be jelly turns to sort of like a glass crystal, and that's how it lives. Can't remember what that thing's called. It's pink. It looks really weird. I don't know. You can Google it. But, yeah, and, sorry, somebody's writing something here. Oh, I know. Let me pull out that older map that the Piri Reis map is based on. Because it's definitely worth looking at. Incidentally, if anybody wants to read about the Piri Reis map, Charles H. Hapgood, Maps of the Ancient Sea Kings, that was published in 1966. I have an edition republished in 1996. And if you give me a second here, I will find Finneas. That's what it is, the Finneas map. F-I-N-A-E-U-S. Yeah, that's the one that has, it actually has the two separate islands. Antarctica's actually made out of two land masses, and it depicts them. So that would have been, like I said, about 3 million years ago. Have you researched the abduction, which claim Bigfoot and all other people? No, I don't know what you're talking about, Sadaba. As far as abduction is concerned, I'm in the school of thought that thinks it's actually mythological, spiritual. It's some sort of trans-dimensional thing going on as opposed to a nuts-and-bolts alien abduction. You have tales in the Middle Ages of fairies and goblins, and even further back you have other accounts. Again, gets into the ancient aliens thing a bit, but I would... If anything's going on, I would probably say it has something to do with interdimensional things, because that is more internally consistent. Zachariah Sitchin had the idea of the Anunnaki that were enslaving humans to make us mine things for them. But if you have the technology to travel across the universe, why in the world do you need slave labor? And for that matter, there's asteroids in the asteroid belt that are almost pure gold, silver, and platinum. Why would you need to come to Earth for that? And then changing human DNA and all of that, that blows my mind. Yeah, Bigfoot definitely could be interdimensional. That would explain how they're able to not be detected and how we don't find any of their bodies. But we're just debating. I mean, it's almost impossible to prove. And I'm the kind of person that likes to have things he could prove. The giant squid, for years and years, everybody thought the giant squid was a lot of BS, and then one washed up on shore, and, well, I guess there are giant squid. Maybe that's what those sailors in the 1600s were talking about being monsters. There's a really crappy... TV show out of Canada that was called The Trailer Park Boys, but at one point you've got these rednecks trying to build a model railroad track over a river into Maine so they could smuggle weed into the United States, and these boys don't know what beavers are, so they call them the river monsters. Oh no, the river monsters are back and attacking us. I thought that was great. When you have ignorance and of people, they humans want to come up with an explanation, even if it's a silly one. And when we get into issues of, you know, like I said, yeah, I'm in the opinion that it's a transdimensional thing, but I have absolutely no way to prove it. I'm just speculating. And you have the issue of an argument out of ignorance. I don't know, therefore I do know. And that doesn't work. And I'm guilty of this. We're all guilty of it. I try to avoid it as much as possible. But sometimes when, because you want to keep an open mind. You don't want to just, oh, that's bullshit. I'm not listening to that. He's full of crap, blah, blah, blah. I know I might sound that way when I talk about Zachariah Sitchin, but I've read one of his books. The man's nuts. And, oh, he knows how to translate cuneiform. Well, then why don't the other guys that translate cuneiform agree with his translations? Oh, he's single-handedly figured out how to reinterpret a whole language on his own? Come on. I mean, you know, that's almost like, you know, somebody taking 10 hits of acid every day for 3 months and then translating the true definition out of the newspaper and predicting the future. I mean, I think Zachariah Sitchin has done a great disservice to the study of ancient history because he's created this whole cottage industry of ancient aliens and, you know, the History Channel, which, don't get me started on the History Channel. I absolutely loathe the History Channel. But that it used to just be the Nazi Channel. It's just Nazis, Nazis, Nazis. World War II, World War II. That's all they did. Now, it's Nazis and aliens. I don't know what's going to be next. But there was one History Channel special where they were I actually wanted to do like an angry video game, James Rolfe style parody of this and film it and put it on YouTube, but I'm a really shitty actor, I found out, so it's not going to happen. But they had this thing where they were talking about a water mill that powered a saw that could cut limestone and make a nice straight cut to make a block. Well, they had this archaeologist at a museum in Cairo with a little model explaining how it worked, and she was saying the blades were made out of copper, and the copper didn't have teeth because it wouldn't cut through the stone. Be too brittle. So what they did is they had flat copper bars and a slurry made out of, I think it was crushed quartz. And quartz, of course, is harder than limestone. So in a slurry mixed with water with this copper bar rotating back and forth, or rather reciprocating up and down along this block, it would slowly grind into it and cut it. It would take days. But the History Channel would cut to the CG model of this giant saw with huge teeth sawing through the stone, and then cut back to the lady with the model saying specifically how it didn't have any teeth. That one really got to me. Still gets to me to this day. Because they went out of their way to be wrong. It's one thing if you take somebody's word for something and don't verify their sources or something like that, but to just go out of your way and create a CG scene, a computer-generated image that is wrong, I can't stand that. South Park did a funny parody of this recently, by the way. Yeah. And another thing, if you want, let's see, I can get into some of the Lewis and Clark expedition. There's an interesting development with that. Meriwether Lewis was living in the late 1700s and early 1800s. He was basically taken under Thomas Jefferson's wing and taught botany and mathematics, such that he would be able to look at the stars and figure out what his latitude and longitude were, and you know, for making a map on the expedition. They set out in 1804 from Harper's Ferry, which is on the Potomac River in what's now West Virginia. At the time, it was Virginia. Went down there. Basically, in 3 years, they went across the country and back again. And the map that Meriwether Lewis drew, which was completely eyeballed, he would just look at a tree down the river. Okay, that's a mile. Write it down. Okay, that one over there, that's 2 miles. Write it down. In this way, he made a map of his mileage from Harper's Ferry to Oregon or Washington State and back again. And he was accurate to within 100 miles, which I think is just remarkable. And another story I could tell from that one was one time Meriwether Lewis was going out hunting. And when he was going out, he encountered a grizzly bear that was attacking another one of his comrades. And three or four people from the expedition shot this grizzly bear, and it just kept coming at him. So Lewis, he would go around with his Kentucky long rifle and an espontoon. An espontoon is kind of like a pike, and it has like a hook coming on the side of it so you can grab somebody on a horse and yank them off and stab them to death. He'd use that as a gun prop for his long rifle. Anyway, he just stood there in the middle of the river after he discharged his one and only round and was getting ready to stab the grizzly bear, and then somebody else finally fired a fifth shot, and that's what took the thing out. And when the natives were warning him about this at the Mandan villages, they'd seen black bears and brown bears before, but they didn't think that such a creature could exist. Then there was another time when they were trying to go down the Cascade Mountains on the Columbia River. There was a waterfall and a rapid system that was like 3 miles long, and it dropped something like 200 feet, or maybe it was more than that. Everybody thought they were crazy. The natives thought they were insane, but they had this boat with all their stuff on it and 40 guys, this big keel boat, and they rode that thing down the rapids, and everybody thought they were just gonna be destroyed, and somehow they survived. There's a whole series of these little almost miracles that occur. There's a whale that washes up on shore and saves the men because they were desperate for fat. By the way, if you only have elk to eat and you're out in the Pacific Northwest, you'll starve to death because apparently the meat is so lean, it's like a pure protein diet. You're not getting any fats or certainly no carbs, unless you're eating leaves or sticks or something. Bosnian pyramid. Oh yeah, the vitrification of rock. Newgrange has vitrified rock on it. And Newgrange, as far as we know, isn't really that ancient. Vitrification of rock could occur from coronal mass ejections from the sun. And that's getting back to that plasma event that could have spelled the end of the last ice age. And that could have vitrified also the smoky quartz around the Bosnian pyramid. As far as I've researched, the Bosnian pyramid is man-made, and that it has vitrified rock on it is really weird and unique, but it's not particularly rare geologically on the surface of the Earth. There's other examples of vitrified rock from things that we know perfectly well were man-made. So vitrification has occurred during the time humans have been roaming around, even after they became behaviorally modern by the 30,000 years ago mark. Yeah, granite with quartz running through it. That's very common. Quartz is granite is a continental rock. It's felsic. I live in an area of Virginia where 80% of the rocks I see are quartz, quartzite, or granite. And there will be these big bands of quartz crystals growing within the granite. The reason that happens is because quartz is mostly made out of silica. It's a silicate mineral. And the crystals of that silicate need a relatively low pressure and low temperature to form. If you have a mountain that's I'm sorry, guys, I can't name a mountain ridge in Britain. But if you got the Alps, for example, and you drill way down into the center of the Alps, you're going to find pressure and temperature sufficient to create quartz because of the weight of the rock on top of it pushing down. And as that rock on top of it is eroded away from the weather, and you have a process of isostasy or isostasy that raises the continent again, because if you have a block of wood that's floating and you chop off the top half of it, the block's actually going to rise a little bit out of the water because it's rebalancing itself as far as its floating is concerned. And the crust is floating on top of a molten layer of rock called the mantle. So when you erode a mountain down, the whole landmass will rise up a little bit to balance itself out. That will expose granite that has these veins of copper, veins of quartz running through them. And you could also have veins of other stuff too. It just depends on how hot and how much pressure there was, and different minerals will form at different pressures. Diamonds are really rare because they pretty much have to come through a mafic intrusion, like basically liquid mantle magma coming up and then solidifying, and then all of that stuff around it eroding away so that it exposes it. That's how you get kimberlite. It's extremely rare, but you also have to remember that De Beers has a monopoly on the diamond industry, and they own millions of times the diamonds that are known to exist on the market. If they released all of these diamonds that they've been mining out of Africa with slave labor for the past 200 years, and it's still slave labor, don't have any doubts about that, diamonds would be about as cheap as quartz. They're not that rare because they've spent so much money mining it. And it's sort of a catch-22. You mine a whole bunch of something that's valuable. It's just like Spain in the 1500s. They quadrupled the gold supply in all of Europe. Oh, yeah, you're really rich. You got all this gold. Guess what? Price of gold dropped. You got too much of it. You flooded the market. De Beers doesn't want to flood the market with diamonds, so they hold them back. And it's not even a conspiracy. You could just look this up. It's known. And legally, you can't do anything about it because it's a private company. If they want to hold it and not sell their product, they can do that. And they own probably 99.9% of all the diamond mining operations on the earth. So, you know, the blood diamond thing is just the little side of the market that De Beers isn't able to monopolize. But yeah, I really hate De Beers. I mean, there's even footage of, you know, they have these dump trucks filled with diamonds, you know, driving into these, you know, vault complexes that they have, where they, you know, their own Fort Knox. I don't even know what country they're based out of. It might even be Britain. I'm not sure. Yeah, 2 minutes left. Well, we've stumbled our way through a two-hour show again. That's nice. I didn't have as much material this time as I would have wanted to, because I've been driving 200 miles a day helping out my grandparents. Well, if anybody has any questions, of course, Joshua Jenkins on Facebook. There's a link on Dark City Radio website. Ever want to ask me anything, shoot away. Sorry I couldn't say anything much else about Bigfoot or any of that, but I'm not going to lie. So, a source for Bigfoot information, if you're interested, is Missing 411 from David Palaides. It's Paul with IDES at the end, PAULIDES. He's got a lot of research done on that and missing people's cases in United States national parks. Very, very strange stories where a guy disappears and all they find is his leg bone inside of his pants. Like, he just, you know, was eaten, and all that's left is like his foot in his shoe and his lower leg bone, and his pants are just there, like he was like gobbled up and some, I don't know, it's weird. It's just as weird as the feet washing up on the west coast of the United States a few years ago.